This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue and excuse for me to explore my curiosity through combos with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Michael Ashcroft. He is a climate and energy consultant turned Alexander Technique teacher. Michael talks and teaches about awareness through his blog and course called Expanding Awareness. Michael and I talk about what Alexander Technique is and isn't, how to cultivate awareness, effortless effort, the importance of direct experience, and much more. Please enjoy.
So I have a strange background as an Alexander Technique teacher. I studied physics undergrad at university and then spent 10 years working in various roles in low carbon electricity system innovation, that kind of thing. So tech innovation or the management of tech innovation through the electricity system. And I went from that to Alexander Technique bizarrely, because I had a bad knee situation. I have very bad knees. They dislocate really easily. It's been a chronic thing since I was 11. And I had it in my head from various places that Alexander Technique helped with posture and body stuff. And I was going through a particularly anxious period in my 20s where I was like, I want to protect my knees and prevent long-term degeneration, that kind of thing. So I went along to a class and then I realized it was something very different from what I had imagined. Very little focus on posture. Unusually, given the profession, my teacher is very weird in that regard. I'm very grateful that I found him, not someone else. But I had my first lesson and thought, oh, okay, this is interesting. This is awareness, Zen, meditation-y kind of stuff rather than it is posture stuff. And I was pretty sold. But that was in 2014. And I decided to do a kind of a weird double life for a while. So I trained part-time as a teacher because I was so interested for 3 years while still doing my career in energy innovation. And it wasn't until 2020, just during COVID, that I thought, okay, I can do something different now. Built this online thing and made a go of it on my own. But I never intended to be a teacher of this thing in the traditional model. The idea of like people coming and see you, you work on all the people, wasn't appealing enough for me to throw in my old career. But this new way is a lot more interesting to me. So yeah, here we are.
It's one thing to really appreciate the practice and realize personally the benefits from it. It's an entirely other thing to go and train and then eventually switch careers and teach that thing full time. What was that transition like? Why were you so drawn to it? What were the benefits you were seeing?
It's really interesting because I had both like push and pull factors involved at the time. So, you know, I didn't quit at the moment that I became a teacher, right? There was a long period in between. And I think that for me, the push factors were more salient. Of course, having things to jump to was useful as well. But I had been having an increasingly tough time in conventional work. I had some mental health issues and burnout experiences. And the more I tried to push through, the more difficult it became to land somewhere I was happy to stay for the rest of my career. So if I was at 100% before my burnout, I couldn't get beyond 65 or 70%. So I had to change something. And I wasn't content staying at 70%. So the combination of that and actually COVID, honestly, because I was able to work from home more and people were very online, I could play around with this new way of teaching and people were into it. So those factors came together, meaning that I could leap and feel confident in leaping, that I had a thing to leap to. In terms of the draw toward it, I mean, my journey has been really interesting because it feels like I've come more and more to life the more I practice this thing. I've been able to step into who I am more the more I practice by stripping away all the things that are kind of clogging up my system. You know, the idea of technical debt is very salient here. Like all the stuff that's built up that I can now like undo through this practice. And when I undo it, other stuff shows up and that stuff is more who I am and more who I want to be. So it just felt right and natural to go into this.
I love the application as a product manager. I love the application of technical debt to this space.
I should claim that one. That one isn't my own invention. Go and look on Twitter. Meditation Stuff, who is also a technical background at Meditation Stuff, came up with that one, not me. So awesome. Attribution where it's due.
Awesome. We'll throw that in the show notes. So I think a lot of listeners will be familiar with different mindfulness practices. A number of Eastern traditions, but maybe less familiar with what Alexander Technique is. So can you give a primer on it and maybe in a kind of 80-20 analysis on the key points of it?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So Alexander Technique is essentially a mindfulness practice that relates heavily to movement in the body and that kind of thing. It's often used by performers, actors, people in sports, musicians, that kind of thing, mostly taught in like drama schools and conservatories and that kind of thing. And that's because the heritage of Alexander Technique comes from a guy called F.M. Alexander. He was an actor, and he overcame vocal difficulties through this technique that he was encountering when he was up on stage giving giving presentations, if you like, giving kind of Shakespearean performances. So he couldn't figure out why it wasn't working, why he kept losing his voice. He went home and basically spent years testing stuff on himself and figured out various things, which is now the technique. So I do it a bit differently. If you Google around, you'll see people talking about posture or movement or that kind of thing at most performance, but I've gone a layer deeper almost, or layer more focused on the internal experience, which we talk about in terms of awareness. So I call it an awareness-based practice in contrast with, say, meditation, which is often more of a concentration-based on the cushion practice. Alexander Technique is done all the time in activity and broad noticing, and in particular, noticing things you're about to do, let's say condition patterns, condition habits, and learning how to not do them in a constructive way, as opposed to kind of going off and letting your preconditioned ways of being just do that thing on autopilot.
Excellent overview. So you alluded to kind of the traditional background of Alexander Technique or what it's intended to help people with, and how you've kind of taken some of those underlying principles, but then repurposed it for kind of a broader or more mental and emotional focused aim. You've done that while also taking a course that at least my understanding is it's normally taught in person, and taken it online. So those are two challenging things to do at once. Yeah. What has been seamless about that kind of translation of the technique to a broader subject and taking it online, and then what has been challenging?
I think I've benefited a lot from my style of teaching that I got from my own teacher, because most people, I think most teachers going online and doing the posture movement stuff would have found it much more difficult, because that's much more of a one-on-one and see the student, how they move and that kind of thing. What I'm teaching is a lot more noticing skills and that kind of thing. And for that, things like online video and online content is getting to the point now where the stuff is good enough that you can convey enough via this format. So that was surprisingly easy, actually, to relay the stuff that I learned. What's been difficult, I think, is communicating that there's actually a there, if you like, because it can be quite difficult to articulate this stuff, partly because I think the stuff that we're pointing at accesses the parts of the brain that don't use language or something like that. A lot like, say, Eastern religions and all of that kind of, you know, what are you actually talking about when you say these words? You're pointing to an experience that can be really hard to actually point to. So finding ways to avoid people confusing the finger for the moon, if you like to use that Zen expression, so to make sure they kind of get the right thing or the thing that I'm pointing at rather than the thing they hear me pointing at. So a bunch of different like ways of describing the thing have been really helpful. And that was difficult at first.
I want to double click on that, because that was one of the impressions or experiences I had as I was researching this topic. I've dabbled a bit in Buddhist and Taoist philosophy, and I saw a lot of overlap between this idea of you can't actually explain this to somebody. There has to be direct experience of it. And you use the don't mistake my finger pointing at my finger for the moon analogy.
Yeah.
What are some of the better tools or metaphors that you've come up with to help get people there understanding the limitations of language?
So normally I kind of do a kind of guided experience of like, I realized a bunch of calls basically. So I go back a little bit, how until I got the course. Before I had the course, I did like 30 or 35 Zoom calls with people, just to see if they were interested. That was during lockdown, which was quite handy. Nothing else to do, during my week off work. And I basically realized that if I said the right things in the right way, in the right order, most people would have some kind of experience that was roughly what I was pointing towards. So I often don't know what work for people, except that some constellation of ideas will land for some and some things won't for others at all. So I still have to use quite a few. And then what I'll say is, you need to do the work of finding out what the moon is here. Like, I'm pointing at something and I'm putting it on you ultimately. I can kind of hint in that direction. And then you need to figure it out. And going from there, there are some areas where I actually haven't found ways of pointing at it. But all I can say is, you know what the moon thing was over here? I want you to just apply that over here now, this new place. I don't know how you'll do that, but like the experience you had in this direction, just do that over here. Tends to shortcut having to start from the beginning. But for example, the main frame I use is one of expanded or spacious awareness. So I will encourage people to become more broadly aware of their environment, particularly up and behind, because we're very forward and down oriented animals with eyes forward and head that's a bit off center. So we kind of fall forwards if we're not careful. And we're always looking down as well, particularly in the modern era with phones and laptops and stuff. So if I guide people into a spacious awareness state, they start to notice things that are interesting. And then, you know, there's a move associated with noticing that you're contracted in your awareness and going, oh, look, I'm contracted, zoom out. And I can't, you know, in person, I can give you that experience through touch, which is a whole different thing, but I can't do that over the internet. So I have to point and point and point and, you know, you get there in the end. And people repeatedly now have experiences. I'm thinking, yeah, okay, that's the thing. Good. I'm reassured.
Your course and blog are called Expanding Awareness, and you just mentioned this idea of typically we have this kind of periphery awareness of things that are going on around us. You might argue it's somewhat limited, and you're trying to increase that sense of spatial, but then cognitive awareness as well. Is it purely an evolutionary reason that we've developed this kind of myopic or like blinders on view of the world that's going on around us? Or what are the conditions that have got us to this point that we now have to kind of unlearn?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I need to say that I don't know for sure, and I'd be cautious about claiming that I do. But my pet theory, which is echoed also in a book called The Master and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist, which talks about brain hemispheres. And actually my teacher, my AT teacher, used the same example I'm about to use long before any of I discovered this stuff. I don't think he's read it either, so that's reassuring. But animals like us have to solve a fundamentally tricky existential issue, which is we have to be able to hunt to eat, and we have to avoid being predated, right? We're predator and prey. So if you imagine that you're going after a deer or a gazelle or something, you want to like, or a smaller thing like a rabbit, you want to like not lose it in your awareness, in your attention. Like you want to zoom in, laser in, like that's the thing, don't lose it. But if you over-contract and forget about the wider space, then you might be caught by a scorpion, an eagle, a lion or whatever. You know, there's stuff out there that will get you. So you have to resolve being able to do both of those things, narrow beam attention and broad peripheral awareness at the same time. Now, the way that Ian McGilchrist says we solve this is by having two hemispheres. The left one does attention, the right one does awareness, simplifying enormously. The reason that I think we get overly contracted now is that, again, McGilchrist's model is that we've built a world that favors the left hemisphere, that favors the concentration, that favors the attention. All these devices buzzing around us, all the words and categories that we interact with, it's all kind of not entirely real in a sense. It's not the same as being just walking along the savannah and going like, this is my entire existence. We're often like in a simulation or off somewhere else. So it's very easy for that narrow beam attention thing to dominate. Now what they should do is work together. So you have sustained narrow beam attention that can move easily from thing to thing in the context of a wide open spacious awareness. But what seems to happen to most people in the modern age is that they over-focus and then lose that spacious awareness, which comes with a bunch of issues because you kind of need the spacious awareness for a bunch of stuff, like seeing the context, seeing the relationship between things, the flow of time. All of these things come from the spaciousness and noticing, but we're so zoomed in that we miss the big picture ultimately.
On your blog, you use this quote by or misattributed to Viktor Frankl. That's something like awareness is the space between stimuli and reaction. When you think about it like that, the question I always come back to, and the thing I have trouble with cultivating in my own life, is going back to kind of viewing awareness as like a software layer. We were talking about technical debt. Can you build in a kind of permanent abstraction layer or middleware between the stimuli and the reaction that's just always there and becomes your default process? Or is this something you have to constantly remind yourself of in practice?
I'm going to give you the annoying answer of both, but I'll explain why. When you first start out doing this, you realize that the space between stimulus and response is either very small or just zero. So actually, I'll bring another example from computer science, the idea of functions in programs. So normally the code goes top to bottom in a straight line. And that's, you know, you'd have to repeat a lot of stuff basically to you know, add a new variable. So define a name, print something. It's like, okay, here's just the code every single time. It's tedious. So what you do in computer science is you have a function that you just call, it does the thing, sends the answer back, and then, okay, you carry on. So it's just much more efficient and cleaner. I think that humans have something like functions. So everything like sitting down, answering a question, picking up a glass, like all the stuff, tying shoelaces, all the stuff that you've learned to do is just made more efficient by calling the function and then, you know, doing it and then carrying on. The issue is, from what I've seen in a Tarn technique, is there are some downsides to this if you do it in a kind of low consciousness way for a couple of reasons. One is that the thing you learned in the function might not be the right response every time. So the way that you learned to tie your shoelaces when you were, you know, six is actually not a good way of tying your shoelaces, right? You've got an entrenched habit there that you now, you know, can't change very easily, particularly if when you go to tie your shoelaces, it just happens the way it always has done and you don't notice that you're doing it the way you always have been. There's an experience where when you're in a function like this, your vividness of the world, your consciousness kind of diminishes a little bit. And this is the thing we see over and over again in Alexandre technique of, you ask someone to do an activity and they kind of check out a little bit from the start to the end, and then they kind of get full consciousness back when they're finished. So you got to sit down. As you're sitting down, you're like not fully present. Then you finish sitting down, you kind of settle and you're like, okay, I'm back. You don't recognize it's happening necessarily, because while you're in the function, your consciousness is diminished enough that you don't notice your consciousness has diminished. There's a bit of a meta issue there. And going back to the stimulus and response issue, if the gap is too small or not there, then you'll just jump from function to function to function in a kind of lower consciousness, kind of daydreamy, not quite there state, which makes it very difficult to intervene. So going back to your question around KD permanently, the game, if you like, is to slowly raise your baseline so that you get better at noticing, so that your default response is that you have more spaciousness. But it's never really a thing that happens fully on its own. You just get better at happening in the background. So the way I describe this is like you're pinging the world a little bit. And my teacher used an expression from someone else, which is the present moment lasts for 3 seconds. Like this is a classic issue of mindfulness of, you can't go like, oh, I'm so mindful, and then forcibly hang on to the present moment. Like you have to keep choosing it. Like, okay, there it is. There it is. There it is. Because otherwise you just slip off into the function, daydreamy and low consciousness state. You have to keep asserting your consciousness, if you like, a little bit. So basically you just get better at doing that the more you practice, and it kind of becomes more of a background process. Like there's a part of my brain now, I think, that just pings the world for me. Whereas at the very beginning, the practice was, can I go a week and not forget about this entire thing? For example, it just gets easier and easier the more you do it.
Having worked with a few hundred people now in cultivating this sense of awareness, I'm curious what the most common roadblocks or limitations or self-limiting beliefs are to people achieving that, or mm-hmm. continually working at it, since it is a mixture of, since you responded with both.
Yeah. I think one of the main traps for people is trying too hard, honestly. Particularly for most people who find me tend to be very thinky people. They're normally quite successful. Let's say, again, software developers as the example. and they're like used to working very hard. They're used to grinding. They're used to learning new skills by trying hard for them. The issue is, you know, I was describing the attention awareness model earlier. The more you try, the more you narrow focus. Unfortunately, the more you're likely to lose the spacious awareness. So one of the biggest roadblocks is encouraging people to really trust that they can learn a different way, that this thing is a thing that doesn't require effort, which goes so counter culture in a lot of cases, unfortunately. It's like, no, I need to try. I've paid for this thing. I have to try hard and get the most out of it. Like, okay, maybe. Or consider that in this space, that's the opposite of what you need. You're here to unlearn things, not to do things where you always have done them. There's a quote from Alexander, if you always do what you did, you'll get what you always got. Or some, maybe that's someone else actually, but something of that nature. What was it that he said? Oh yeah, sorry, that's it. Trying is only emphasizing the thing you already know. That's his quote. That was someone else last time. So the more that you try, the more you're just calling the function button even harder, right? You're like, I have a function, I'm going to try, and like, okay, push the call button. But we're trying to call different functions, but we're stepping out of function land, if you like, and trying to let something new show up. So you actively can't try. How can you try to do something you've never done before? Doesn't make any sense. You have to allow something else to emerge that's appropriate for the situation.
This idea of effortless effort and non-doing is fundamental to this technique. As I mentioned before, it's pretty fundamental to some of these Eastern traditions as well.
Yeah.
And yet, as we were talking about, the limitations of language make it very difficult to communicate this to someone. What's the best explanation or tool you've come up with to help people internalize this idea of non-doing or effortless effort?
I think the best way is to point to experiences that people have anyway, where this happens naturally or spontaneously, and then say, so what's going on there? Like, why is that different from how you normally are? So a lot of people have the experience, let's say in a sports context, where, you know, let's say baseball or something, or tennis, where the ball's flying at you, and in one mode, you're like, oh, I can try really hard and try and swing the bat, and I can try and, like, make contact, and, you know, you know what that's like. The other one is you show up with a certain level of trust and it's almost as if the bat just swings itself. And you're like, okay, why did that happen differently? What's the difference there? And it's actually really funny. You can see professional sports people go from one to the other. We call it choking, right? So like they're on a roll, they're doing really well. Then something happens. They become aware of their performance. They get stuck somehow and you can see them get more stuck because they try to get out of it. They're like, okay, I've got to try to get back what I had before. What was I doing? And they get more and more and more in their heads and less trusting. And the performance gets worse. The way out of that is to kind of notice the entire thing, zoom out and like, okay, no, it's okay. I trust. I'm going to allow my system to coordinate itself in response to what's going on. So I point to that kind of thing and say, it doesn't have to be in sports context. That kind of thing is happening all the time. So the more that you can trust your system to respond appropriately, the less you will feel the need to intervene, if you like, to kind of add more, like that point of hitting the ball is, I need to try harder to make sure I hit the ball. Like nonsense. You can't calculate how fast the ball's going, the air resistance or the angles. Like there's no part of your brain that your thinking mind that you call you is doing that. It just happens. It happens everywhere in life. So same as I was saying before, that's the finger that points to the moon. So whatever the finger is in that context of that sports context, play with that and then, you know, apply that to sitting down, writing an email, talking to someone. It's the same fundamental principle.
The idea that you don't have to try implies that this like unified idea of your mind and body, that you have this natural capacity to already do these things. And it is our mind, our conditioning that's affecting our ability to do that. Is that a correct understanding? Like, do you think that there's something within us that's already naturally able to do this? Or is it that we still have to learn through repetition and practice how to do the thing, but then we have to remove our kind of, or I think you call it like the trying mind. trying to understand to what degree we have this natural capacity, but we obscure it?
It's a really interesting question. And I think the answer has to be quite nuanced, because clearly we learn stuff, you know, growing up. We don't come preloaded with everything we ever have to do, and we have to learn something. I think it comes down to how we learn and how we start to interfere when we have the capacity to interfere. So consider how a child learns, for example, before they're obviously self-conscious about anything. They are led by play. They are naturally curious. They are non-judgmental towards themselves. And everything seems to be easy. I don't mean in the sense that, you know, they don't cry or that kind of thing, but like they don't have to force themselves necessarily to like learn something in a particular way, or they don't intervene in their own behavior in ways that, let's say, a teenager might. But if you take the other example, as the child gets older, let's say that you're 12 now and you suddenly have the idea that you need to be socially acceptable. Right, perhaps there's a cool way of walking or talking or something you have to do to be liked. And now you have the cognitive capacity to look at your own behavior and go like, oh, that's not how I want it to be. I want to say to you over here differently. Now that's a useful function, right? Humans need this to exist in society. It's probably why it's developed. But I think it comes with, let's say, errors, downsides, whatever you want to call it, because we're not very good at laying down these things in a way that doesn't cause the side effects. So they might not be the best way of doing the thing. We could over effort when we were doing it. But the very fact that it's possible for someone to decide to walk differently than the way they're spontaneous implies that, you know, we're overriding something in a sense, like, no, I'm not going to walk naturally. I'm going to walk like this. Again, that's fine for a while, as long as you know that you're doing it. But the moment that you forget that you're doing it, you know, at some point when I was 13, I walked differently on purpose, and then I forgot. So this became how I've always walked, right? And I can't do anything differently because I've worn such a deep groove in my conditioning that a different way of being is difficult to access at this point. So I think it's just a natural consequence of a very powerful human mechanism that is very useful, that's being wielded in ways that, you know, we don't necessarily know how to use or the consequences thereof.
And you have a great essay on this topic and kind of this progression from, I think, what you call unconscious naturalness at birth to a more conditioned and unnatural way of being. I highly recommend everyone check that out. One of the questions that's intimately tied to what we're talking about here that I had as I was reading that essay, I have a 1.5-year-old daughter, and I see her currently in the state you were describing at the beginning, where it's this effortless play. She's just kind of flowing. There's no real thought to her actions. It's very natural. And it raised the question whether it's possible. Right now, the current kind of progression for us is be natural, be affected by society and the environment, so we become a little bit unnatural. And then hopefully for some of us, we unlearn that gradually. Is there a way to preempt that within a child such that they don't have to go through that kind of hero's journey of be natural, learn some conditioned habits, and then hopefully unlearn it?
Yeah, I don't know, but let's see what we can come up with. I do wonder, it's just a natural progression that humans have to go through because we're not animals, if you like. Well, we are animals, but we're no longer non-self-aware animals. So if you consider a cat is always spontaneous. A cat is always naturally a cat all the way through a cat's life, because it never, to the best of our knowledge, has that ability to kind of go, oh, I'm not a very cool cat, I'm going to jump differently, right? It never has that moment as it goes in its journey. But humans, your daughter will have that moment. And there will be a period of, I mean, you could even call it a fall from grace in a sense. Like self-consciousness happens, intervention happens consciously, and you have to unlearn that. What I would focus on is what are the conditions that would help to maintain as much of the initial poise as possible and then be able to step out of it by herself as time goes on. So noticing all the ways in which she's starting to you know, get involved in herself, start to notice that judgmental voice saying, no, do it differently. This is very often an internalized voice of parents, of teachers, of society, that kind of thing. Like, you know, I am bad for X, therefore I'll be Y kind of thing, which is a huge trap, I think. But just doing whatever's possible to avoid losing that sense of playfulness. So avoid life becoming a grind, I would say. Or it's not even a grind. You can have a grind playfully. But just, yeah, just to maintain that playful spirit, I think. That naturally curious-led way of being, as a master coordination system, if you like, as opposed to needing to be a particular way. I guess that's the transition that we're pointing at.
And it's complicated by the fact that I'm wrestling with this simultaneously as I'm hoping to mitigate the effects of it for her. You alluded to this double-edged sword that is consciousness. The kind of less or unconscious animal, like a dog or something, pure just has a natural way of being. They can't be anything but a dog. But humans have developed this capacity to be aware of ourselves such that we kind of straddle this line between the animal and this kind of higher consciousness being. Awareness is a way to hopefully somewhat return us back to that more natural state of being. In doing so, though, do we, and this is a bit of a devil's advocate take, I'm prodding you to see if there's something here, although I'm not sure I believe it. In cultivating awareness, do we lose something? Do we lose some kind of edge that nature has naturally developed for us through this idea of consciousness and kind of this tunnel vision we get when we approach life?
Good question. I like it. I think it's, you have to be careful when you mean nature and what nature gave us. So nature gave us the coordination mechanisms, the body and whatever else, to survive in a certain kind of world and thrive in a certain kind of world. Alexander's argument, which I think I agree with, is that the process of civilizing, if you like, so away from equivalent of being a cat to where we are now, happened very quickly in evolutionary time and happened very dramatically. Like right now, I am a very long way from the conditions that were present from, let's say, cats like humans, the kind of humans who were not able to intervene in their own way of being and were purely spontaneous. It's not normal for someone like this to stand inside all day, you know, at a desk with bright lights and, you know, on a computer. Like, it's not how nature designed us to be. Although I'm sure we've adapted pretty quickly, even in the time that we've had access to these things. But the last few hundred years, difficult. Even sitting down, you know, what humans sat down much before, you know, modern civilization happened. But yeah, it's such a tricky one, because it comes back to where modern society demands an edge from us, doesn't it? If I were to lose my tunnel vision capacity, then maybe I won't function so well at work. Maybe in the city life that I've now become accustomed to, maybe it's actually adaptive to be hyper narrowed and focused. I'm not convinced that it is. I think there's a huge cost in that. But I can see a case for, if your job involves you just grinding through stuff and to hell with the consequences, maybe you just don't want the awareness skills. Maybe you'll see a thing you don't want to see. Maybe you think, oh, okay, I have to change something now, or whatever. You just live with the cost that it's incurring on you. I'm not convinced by that. I think it's always better to see what's going on and to be able to intervene consciously in not doing things that harm you, shall we say. And I do also believe that even in that kind of context, in that kind of grindy job, your system still works better when you're not in the way, and when you're able to zoom out and function differently. It's just harder to see in the context of coding than it is in the context of, you know, throwing a spear at a gazelle, that you want your system to coordinate itself naturally. But it's a good challenge, and I think there are probably edge cases where, for some people, just stay in the groove works, and, you know, to hell with the downsides of it, I think.
And to stick with our computer and technology kind of theme that we've been using as a set of metaphors for this, would you say that when you cultivate awareness, you aren't using kind of like your main processing power continuously such that it affects your ability to focus on work. It's kind of a separate processing, background processing ability that you cultivate. Basically, it's not prohibiting you from still being able to focus on things. It's just giving you the capacity to see the things around you and then decide what to focus on. Is that a fair characterization? Or would you say it is taking away some of that capacity?
I don't think it's taking away. There's a couple of points here. One is that I think the awareness mode, if you like, is more like a parallel processing unit. It can do many things at once. All the stuff that, you know, you beat your own heart somehow without knowing how you do it, you breathe. A whole bunch of stuff happens by itself. And it's good to allow all that stuff to happen by itself. Now, if you, we know that we can intervene in our breathing and we can breathe without a consciousness. And many of us breathe in very silly ways because we've repatterned stupidly, if you like. We've kind of intervened as a bad thing. Imagine if we could consciously beat our own hearts. I'm pretty glad that I can't beat my heart because clearly knows what it's doing by itself. I've never felt the need, like, must beat faster, you know. Not necessary, but I can move my arms around, you know, I can do a bunch of stuff. So on the one hand, I think generally things function better when the spacious mode is engaged. And the narrow beam attention is good for certain kinds of tasks. I mean, I'm not here to deny that you want to be able to laser focus on difficult cognitive, high skill things for as long as you need to. I think one of the reasons why people naturally contract their awareness in modern environments is that our attention control isn't actually all that good. So, you know, there's two things we're talking about. One is attention, for maintaining your attention for however long, and one is the capacity to notice things around you. I think for a lot of people, if we are able to notice things around us, then we find it difficult to sustain attention on something. We get more easily distracted. And I don't think that's an awareness problem. I think that's an attention management problem, if you like, which is a different thing. So people should be training concentration. And I kind of think that the collapse in awareness is a bit of a cope for not having the capacity to sustain attention. So of course, it's easier just like to hyper-focus and tunnel vision. And it works for a given definition of work. But I think there's a better way of doing it, which is be spacious while sustaining attention at the same time.
I think the logical follow-on question here, and maybe where I've been kind of pointing at or hinting at with this last set of questions, is there a relationship between Alexander technique and awareness in general and flow states? Does it help with the ability to kind of manifest that on demand or get you into those flow states faster? Or is there no relationship there?
I think there are relationships. The main one is to notice all the ways in which you're being taken out of flow, I think. So an example, let's say I'm going to start working and I notice something else in my awareness that's calling on me in some way. It could be anything, right? It could be a noise, or it could be a nagging thought I haven't finished something else, or it could be anxiety. All manner of things can show up. And if I'm sufficiently present and aware, I can go like, oh yeah, I'm about to be distracted, and refocus. You can kind of choose to go back. Whereas if you have this contracted state, it's very easy to be taken off by these things without realizing it. And that's the issue. So your attention gets grabbed and dragged over and you still lose focus, but you don't necessarily recognize it happening at the time. So you haven't got conscious control to bring it back. So in that sense, I think it can help nudge you in the right direction. You can exert conscious control when you need to stay on task, for example, and then go through the struggle phase. Like, okay, I'm going to struggle for a while. I'm choosing to struggle. I can see I'm struggling and I'm going to keep going, as opposed to going like, oh, I'm struggling, and unconsciously go off on Twitter, right? Which is a pretty common pattern, I think. The other thing to say about flow is that people often ask me, don't you need tunnel vision for flow? Because a lot of flow states often are like, I was lost in my writing for 3 hours and then I was like, I kind of woke up. Like, oh, where was I? I kind of experienced that's okay. Collapsed awareness, contracted awareness. And I don't think you need that for flow. I just think that the flow is so powerful and the way that we're patterned is so like to focus in and narrow down like that it just happens. But if you take the counter example of spacious flow. So if you imagine like a 2x2 on this one, like one is flow states and one is awareness size almost. You can imagine most flow states people describe are like flow state with contracted awareness, like that coding writing example. But if you also imagine a spacious flow state, let's say a team sport on a field, right? You are definitely spatially aware of everything, right? You have to be aware of the entire thing because that person could throw you the ball, that person could run into you, whatever. You're like playing a big spacious game, but you're definitely in flow at the same time, right? It's not like because you're spacious, you can't be fully engaged and involved in the thing. And I think people just don't call it flow in the same way in that context, or they, when they think of flow, they just go to the cognitive one. But I wonder if there's a way of doing coding writing based flow tasks with the spacious awareness that gives you a very different thing. One of my ideas with this is that let's say you're coding, writing, whatever, in a spacious state, I think it's easier then to notice other ideas as they show up. Like, oh, I'm coding. Oh, I just had this idea to make it so much more elegant and clean and simple. Okay, I should write a comment here. Like these things show up in awareness and then you can act on them. But if you're so tunnel vision down on your way of doing things, you'll spend 2 hours doing it your way and then you'll realize, ah, that was a better way. Damn it. Okay, I could have noticed that an hour ago, right? And that's the cost, I think, one of the costs of the contracted awareness state in a flow context.
I love that distinction between the contracted and spacious awareness states and then the benefits of each. That's super helpful. We've talked mostly thus far about the objectives and the benefits of Alexander technique. I'm curious if you could share kind of two things. One is what you think Alexander technique is not, what it's not intended for. And then also what it should be for, but maybe where there are gaps or limitations in the curriculum or the ways it's been applied.
Interesting. The joke answer is it shouldn't be for posture, but I'm not going to go there. that's my own beef against the profession.
because it's such a narrow application and
it's such a narrow thing that I think, and yeah, I'm sure I would be corrected and appropriately so by one of my colleagues on this one, but I think there's been a bit of a finger moon issue going on even in this domain, because Alexander taught through touch and using bodies, but I think the thing he was pointing at just goes in via the body. But it's much easier to sell and market in, you know, today's era as posture improvement, movement improvement, reducing back pain and that kind of stuff. Like, it's a very good application. Yes, it's also not the thing. The thing is just below that, and posture movement is a manifestation of the thing. Right? That's like my own soapbox I'm going to get off right now. in terms of what I think it's, okay, not for the first one. Do you know there's a term called spiritual bypassing, which is when it's a spiritual issue where you don't look at the things you need to look at, basically. So like there are things that are affecting you in various ways and you consciously choose not to go there and you don't learn a thing you're supposed to learn. And then you're in a bit of a vulnerable position beyond that. I would caution anyone against using Alexander technique to unconsciously do spiritual bypassing. What I mean by that is when you have the capacity to notice stuff and redirect your attention within a broader set of things, it's tempting to go like, oh, there's a thing I don't want to look at. I'm going to go over here instead. Like there's still a need for other practices, I think, and the courage to look at things, even if you don't like them. I think, and it's just that Alexander technique, I think, can be used to avoid stuff that shouldn't be avoided some of the time. Bad application, I think, even though it's possible. And in terms of what it's good for, I think I really want to bring in much more of the non-movementy stuff, honestly, like Alexander technique for public speaking and knowledge work and creativity and like all the stuff that humans are able to do technically falls under the scope of Alexander technique. So it talks about human functioning, both body and mind, which in the AT world are the same process, the same thing. There's no separation. So anything that you do, you can learn to do differently with more consciousness using this kind of technique. It's just that most people haven't thought about it in those terms, and we end up with posture-y stuff. So that's the kind of direction I want to go in. Even though the body stuff is fascinating and really interesting and useful, I want to look into, well, how can you code better with AT, for example? Like, there must be something there because it's something that humans can do. And there's a bunch of habits that we picked up that might not be helpful. Cool. Well, what can we learn there? What can we apply?
When you describe it that way, there's a criminal kind of under application of this technique across domains. And hopefully you'll rectify that. I've mentioned a couple of times the similarities I found in my limited understanding of both Alexander technique and traditions like Buddhism and Taoism, but have sensed a number of similarities. Where do you see these traditions and techniques overlapping or diverging? And then maybe more importantly, and we can address these questions separately, maybe more importantly, are both hinting at or pointing at a same underlying kind of truth or need, which is transcending the ego or kind of overcoming, I think you used the phrase, the trier in one of your essays. So first, the kind of overlap or maybe divergence, and then second, are they just pointing at the same thing from different angles?
Certainly, I see big overlaps in Eastern traditions like Taoism and Zen in particular, and certain Buddhist forms. The Buddhist form I'm most interested in right now is actually called Vajrayana Buddhism, which focuses on spacious awareness as well, although it's less well known. So for sure, like I often find myself talking and thinking, like, that just sounds like Alan Watts. Like, that's kind of the same thing he would say. But I'm pulling from this domain over here. Like, that's interesting. So I think the answer is that many fingers point towards the same moon, shall we say. And I'm always encouraged when I find independently derived fingers, shall we say. So to the best of my knowledge, Alexander, he was born and grew up in Tasmania in Australia, and then moved to London in the early 20th century. To my knowledge, he had no exposure to Zen, Buddhism, or Taoism at all. And yet he independently derived many things, but sound on the face of it quite similar, which I find quite reassuring. So even the term non-doing, translation of wu wei in Taoism, Alexander uses that term. And I think he came to it separately, or it was not a very clear direct link with Taoism, because it captures the thing. Non-try, non-forcing are also good ways of putting it, and I think he uses those as well. So I think there are overlaps, and I think that's because they are pointing at the same kind of experience that is annoyingly hard to put into words, unfortunately. And that's why religions have developed around it, because if you just state something directly, then you lose the shine. You can't just point directly. You have to allude, use metaphors, use ways of seeing that will get people to get the point for themselves. You can't just go like that, unfortunately. So I'm just happy there's an extra tool in the toolbox to point at the thing, ultimately.
Many fingers pointing at the same moon is beautiful, and maybe the best single phrase I've found for explaining the emergence of a variety of religions and spiritual traditions kind of hinting at the same thing. I want to shift a little bit to focusing on you a little bit more personally. You had, as you mentioned in your kind of opening background statement, the shift you had, this macro shift you had from consulting in the climate space to now teaching Alexander technique. And one lens through which you could look at that shift is from kind of a focus on the rational, the logical, the describable, the physical world, to more sensory and felt experience in some way, the indescribable. You had this this sentence in one of your essays that said, even though I don't know how these things work, I know after years of testing that they work. So that's kind of an example of the shift. I'm curious how that has been. What has that transition been like for you? And has it been difficult moving from kind of one approach or macro perspective to the world to another?
Yeah, it's funny because when I was training to be a teacher, I was still more in the physics-y, rational mindset, if you like. So I had enough appreciation for the woo that I was like, okay, there's something here, but I didn't like that I couldn't like pin it down. So I was the annoying empiricist in the room when my teacher would suggest experiments, like, hey, do this and you'll find this happens. I would actively try and break the experiment. So I would like, I would say I was doing X and then, you know, not do X, shall we say, or like just try and falsify the thing over and over again. And in the end, I was like, damn it, there's something here. Okay, fine, if you insist. And my approach is basically focus on empiricism over rationalism, if you like. So I don't need a model of how things work to believe that there's a thing there if I have enough evidence for myself that if I do X, then Y happens, if you like, consistently across people, across time, across context. I am sufficiently, you know, convinced of a thing. And now I'm kind of like looking to fill in the gaps a little bit. I think I was coming into this with enough of an interest in alternative traditions that I was open-minded enough to go for it. So I was, you know, meditating when I was in my teens, reading some, you know, out there books. And I think there's something about people who study physics in particular, I've noticed, tend to be more open-minded because you just get thrown into this, like, the universe is weird, man. And you have to embody that, like, it's really weird. And actually your assumptions are usually wrong. And you know, the more that you learn, the more you realize how much your idea of common sense is stupid at certain levels. So like, sure, why not? Ultimately, I'm very happy to believe that there are things as yet undiscovered. But I don't believe that anything that I'm working with violates any physical laws, if you like. It's just that we don't necessarily always know what the laws are, shall we say. And personally, I think that's how most science has been done through most time during science and existed. Someone had a hunch, went off and tested the hunch and discovered something. You didn't have the model first, you had the hunch first, I think. And this is kind of, yeah, kind of what I tried to follow as well. I still want the models, I still want the frameworks, but you know, I trust my own experience enough, my own ability to navigate ambiguity to kind of go like, okay, this is fine. It has been odd having the career shift, I will say, because I was very much like, you know, yeah, physics, STEM nerd, you know, energy consultant dude. And now I'm online Twitter Alexander Technique Awareness dude. And it's like, I sometimes worry people see me just as that, like the weird guru awareness guy. I'm like, oh, I have this whole thing behind me. And like, no, I'm not as far away from you as you think I am, rational dude. I'm just like, okay, no, I see what I've come to you. Okay, fine. So I'm trying to find ways of like bringing all these things together so that I can be fully authentic to all sides of me, rather than just this new side that's currently dominant, if you like.
You touched on the second shift I wanted to uh-huh. ask a question about. But first, I think my question presuppose this kind of false binary that it's the rational and the emotional and they're separate things, and really your work combines the two. I think ultimately if you zoom out all the way, there is unity there. We're just again kind of looking at this thing from different angles, attempting to identify different aspects of it or describe it. The other shift I'm curious about is this one from kind of I am employed by a corporation, consultant, to now you're self-employed. And you went from kind of like operator to teacher. What has those two shifts specifically been like? So from having this kind of, I don't know if I'd call it reliable, but more reliable income stream to having to kind of, fight for your income a little bit more, and then the shift from maybe in your day-to-day job in consulting, you were doing some amount of teaching, but now it is largely teaching. So that shift from practitioner to teacher.
Yeah, so the solopreneur one first, I guess. I just find that the lifestyle suits me way better. I have been very lucky, I should stress. I haven't had to like grind and push really hard to make enough money to survive. The combination of, you know, my course being popular with Twitter working the way it does, for example, with like people seeing the stuff from far away, I've been able to have a comfortable income for the last 2 years, just from sales of that course and a few other things on the side. It's not like there's abundance, but there's also not concerns either. So it's an interesting place to be in the middle. I also really enjoy tinkering with stuff. So for the 10-year period before I left, I was doing lots of freelance stuff. I was also being a freelance journalist. I was a freelance consultant for a different thing. There was a startup briefly for a year that I got involved in. There's just a whole bunch of little experiments and tinkerings. And my way of being, I think, is much better suited to like generalist approaches. So do some accounting, do some teaching, do some video editing, do some, you know, workshop posting, like all these things. I'm much more able to bring the advantages that I have from the whole of my personality, the whole of my skill set than I was in the job, because I had to hyper specialize. Towards the end, I was working on, you know, regulatory finance for network operators that are licensed monopolies, right? It's so focused, and I knew that I didn't want to keep doing that. I didn't want to specialize. I didn't want to hyper focus on that. I couldn't use my video editing skills. I couldn't use my speaking skills as much, all that kind of stuff. So just, yeah, having the free reign to whoever I want means that I can design things that now I can bring more of myself to it, which is awesome. And the other one you mentioned about, you know, going from operator to teacher, that one feels good, I'll say. Yeah, that's really good. It's just nice. It's nice that when people thank you for something you've done or shared, that they're thanking you as a person, not thanking the job role that you're in. That's been one of the biggest shifts. So people saying like, thank you for this shift I had, thank you for this new experience that I had. And like, that's aimed at me. Whereas if I'm in a corporate environment, you know, thank you for that report, thank you for that project. Like, I know they're thanking me, but they're also like, anyone else with sufficient skills and who is in that role could have done that, like would have done that. So it wasn't, there was like a gap between that and me, whereas now it feels like I'm directly engaging with people. So the impact I feel, even if it's on an individual basis, whereas in my old job, you know, you can affect system change, it feels much more real to me because it's like, oh no, I fought myself to this, therefore they're thanking me, rather than like job title, job description, performing a role stuff. So that's been great, honestly, to experience.
If I could boil my interest in entrepreneurship and solopreneurship in one phrase, I think it's this idea of your outputs being tied to your inputs, both in terms of, like you were talking about, the proximity of the people you're affecting or the companies you're affecting and the feedback you get from that, as opposed to when you're in a multi-thousand person corporation, there's all these abstraction layers or middlemen between you and the output. And that also manifests itself in terms of the income you are or are not making. It's a direct result of the work you're doing. If you're in a salaried position, you can put in 10 hours of work or 40 hours of work in a week, and it might not, you know, move the bottom line. This idea of solopreneurship is a very kind of sexy one in our corner of Twitter currently. Yeah. I think it has been for a while, but feels like there's been a lot more chatter about it recently. What advice would you give to people who are hoping to become a solopreneur themselves? And I think I'm going to make this a bit of a leading question. I really liked your idea of architects versus archaeologists in one of your essays or in one of your YouTube videos. So maybe if it makes sense, incorporating that idea into the response.
Yeah, sure. So the architect and the archaeologist is a model I came up with in response to the problem of how to find your niche, actually how to find your personal monopoly, following David Perel's model. And I realized that I was stuck in a trap, and many people are stuck in a trap of trying to architect out their niche. It's like making lists. So I'm interested in this, I'm interested in that, people are interested in this, what can I get paid for? And like, you know, left hemisphering it, kind of being very rational, like making plans and, you know, following the plan, that kind of thing. And that's just not how I work. And I think a lot of people get stuck in that. And the other model is the archaeologist, who finds something in the ground and then, you know, they have no idea what it is, but they let what they find direct them. The next brushstroke comes from the thing you find rather than what's in your head. So being an archaeologist of this stuff is not imposing anything on yourself of like, oh, I have to do a business in this. It's discovering who you are by experimenting, by playing around. So I discovered, oh, Alexander technique, people like that. Who would have known? This thing that people teach in person through touch, I can do online. I would never in a million years have set out to teach Alexander technique online, because it's probably the worst thing from an architect point of view to teach online. Like, no one does this. It's a terrible idea. It's only because I played around that I realized there was a thing there. And I was in a very fortunate context of the right part of Twitter. Everyone was already online. I had other skills I could bring to it, like communication skills that, were useful. And, hell, the tech skills to set all this thing up and have a high production value is not easy to do. Again, come back to the point of like my multiplicity of skills that weren't being used in the corporate environment, I could use on my own. So the advice I would give is the same thing that I'd give to your daughter, is be playful with it. Is don't try and impose an idea of what it looks like. If you don't know, then go and play. Go and see what you like, see what you discover, see what surprises you. And some of those things might bear fruit. They might be like, oh, I wouldn't have thought that would work, but it does. I guess follow the fun is a bit cliched, but genuinely, like, one of my worst fears of all this was to build myself into a box that I hated living in. And it's so easy to do, like, I'm going to build this startup, I'm going to go and do this thing. And then you realize 5 years down the line that, oh, well, this sucks. If only I'd known. But if you try to keep reorienting as you go along, like, oh, that's still fun. What's fun over there? Then you can keep it in, the whole theme of this conversation is that you work better when you are in playful mode. So if you want to bring your whole playful self to bear, which is the highest functioning version of you I would offer, then it needs to feel playful. So what can you do to keep it playful as you're going along and avoid that grindy, oh no, what have I done sentiment?
Expectation, lists, playful experimentation is such useful advice for all facets of life. So I appreciate that. Just a couple questions in closing. The first is, I'm curious where you want to take expanding awareness as a course, as a brand, if you will. Where do you want to go from here?
Yeah, so it's funny. I gave myself expanding awareness as like a permission container. Like, I didn't feel like I was allowed to talk about this stuff enough. And then I gave it a brand. I was like, oh, no, I can. That was cool. But unfortunately, expanding awareness is a little bit constrained because awareness is just one facet of this thing. So now I'm feeling constrained by my previous permission container, you might call it. So I want to talk more about stuff like aliveness and decision-making and choices and that kind of thing for one. Awareness is one thing, but you can be passively aware, like, oh, look, the world's happening, blah, blah. That's one thing. And I'm not advocating for that. I want to teach you are fully present in the whole world and able to take action and able to navigate and have agency and move around and like, interact. And that's an extremely different way of being than merely watching. And Alexander Technique points at the second one, not the first one. It's not merely watching, it's interacting, participating, being alive, if you like. So I want to go in that direction. One of the ways I want to start doing that is to focus on applications of the thing. So like, rather than just teaching Alexander Technique as like the broad, you are here to learn the technique and go off you go into your own life, I want to teach it as much in like a domain specific thing. Like, you're a public speaker, you're a performer, you're a coder, you're a knowledge worker. Let me reshape this thing around your needs and your existing context. Because I think then I can go deeper into the content in a way that's more useful. And at some point, kind of bring all of that upper level into the master course, if you like. But I think it really helped people to come in with their context and then address their context rather than have to learn the generic thing that everyone's learning and then figure out how to apply it to their own world.
I love that framing of awareness as a kind of the foundational building block from which you build up from. It is not the end in and of itself. You still have to go and do something with it, or else you just become a perpetually passive observer. Exactly. Awesome. Well, this has been an incredible conversation. There's one final question I always ask all my guests, which is, what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with either to act on or to think about?
I would say get curious, or where in your life are you over-efforting? Where do you not trust that your system will just take care of the thing without work from you? And you know, get curious about why is that? Why don't you trust? Why are you putting so much more work in than might be necessary? And then can you gradually, gently just turn down that effort dial and see if things get better or not? See how things change.
That hits home. Awesome. Michael, thank you so much. This has been a blast. And looking forward to continuing to follow your work, all of which will be in the show notes.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Michael.